BBC News.
Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. It has been 16 months since the ultra-conservative Republicans on the Supreme Court overturned Roe. Since then, 14 Republican-controlled states have banned abortion, and 7 have imposed major restrictions on the procedure. Since Roe was overturned, there's been a heightened focus on medication abortion, which is used for more than half of all abortions in the United States. It has also become the latest target for anti-choice activists. But as Ms. Magazine reports, despite abortion restrictions and bans, people are obtaining abortion pills online. The organization Plan C has a comprehensive guide to finding abortion pills on their website, which is continually updated and has all the latest information on where to find abortion pills from anywhere in the country. The Austria-based telemedicine abortion provider Aid Access serves people in all 50 states. Patients of all ages can obtain abortion pills, including advanced provision, for a sliding scale fee of $110. In her new book, Abortion Pills Go Global, Reproductive Freedom Across Borders, today's guest, Sydney Calkin, writes that abortion pills have permanently changed the landscape of abortion care around the world, in countries with and without legal abortion. She writes, quote, "To understand the future of abortion in the U.S. after Dobbs, we must reckon with the impact of abortion pills in other countries where they've transformed the safety and availability of clandestine abortions," end quote. Sydney Calkin focuses on 4 countries in the midst of seismic shifts on abortion: the United States, Poland, Ireland, and Northern Ireland. While Ireland and Northern Ireland have recently moved from near total abortion bans to relatively liberal abortion laws, the United States and Poland have moved in the opposite direction. Sydney Calkin is a senior lecturer in the School of Geography at Queen Mary University of London and co-editor of After Repeal, Rethinking Abortion Politics. Her new book is called Abortion Pills Go Global, Reproductive Freedom Across Borders. Hi, Sydney. Thanks so much for your important book, and thank you for joining us.
Hi, thank you very much for having me on your show.
Well, I wonder, given the work that you do, what was your reaction when you heard that Roe was overturned here in the United States?
Well, you know, we had had that leaked draft opinion a few months before. So I guess the ultimate decision when it came out wasn't much of a surprise. But I think that I had even been pessimistic about the outcome after listening to the oral arguments in the case, because it was pretty clear to me that a majority of the Supreme Court wanted to side with the state of Mississippi and roll back abortion protections in the U.S.
You know, I recently traveled overseas, and the two main issues that shock people from other countries about the United States is the epidemic of gun violence in this country. Sadly, we had another horrific shooting yesterday. And then the abortion decision. People cannot believe that abortion is banned in so many states in this country. What are you hearing from the people you work with around the world?
Well, I think it's an important question, because something a point that I'm trying to make when I'm talking about this book is that, you know, the U.S. is an outlier in the global picture on abortion rights. The countries that are moving to restrict abortion and to more repressive anti-abortion laws are very few, actually. So that's the U.S., Poland, and a few in Central America. Across the rest of the world, what we're actually seeing on abortion rights is countries moving to have more liberal abortion laws. You know, we're seeing huge changes all across Latin America, you know, most recently in Mexico, but also in Argentina, in Chile, in Colombia, and elsewhere in the world. So I think on this, the U.S. is really an outlier.
Right. We've done shows about what is happening in Mexico and Latin America and the green movement, and really the incredible activism that we have seen for so many years in Latin America. And then, of course, the activism that you write about in Ireland. Here in the United States, people asked, how did this happen? And I mean, you can't explain it in a soundbite because now we have minority rule in this country. So you have someone like Donald Trump who did not win the popular vote, but has the power to become the president of this country and has the power to appoint three Supreme Court justices. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's people just shake their head and say, how is this possible that this can happen? So what are your thoughts about the fact that 75% of the United States in survey after survey support abortion rights? But what we're dealing with in this country is a very undemocratic system that allows politicians or someone like a Donald Trump to have so much power over an issue like abortion and, of course, so many other issues.
Yeah, absolutely. It's so deeply troubling. I think it's important to put the abortion issue in a longer term perspective, you know, before the Trump era. I mean, of course, you're right to point out that it was his appointing of so many Supreme Court justices that meant that when the court could take up this issue in the Dobbs case, that they could fully overturn Roe. But there's been such a long and sustained effort to undercut Roe versus Wade, even before the Dobbs decision. So, you know, before Dobbs, we might have talked about the idea of targeted regulation of abortion providers. And this was the idea that the anti-abortion movement realized that they could basically gut Roe and make sure that it really had no practical effect for a lot of people by passing smaller abortion restrictions that fell short of a total ban. So, you know, even before the Dobbs decision that, as you say, has led to abortion bans in 14 states, there were still so many people across the U.S. who were practically unable to access an abortion, even if they lived in a state that permitted abortion, and although they lived in a country where abortion was constitutionally protected.
Right. And I wonder, I don't know if you have any opinions on this, and it's fine if you don't, but I wonder what your thoughts are about the Democratic Party here, because the Democratic Party has also been heavily criticized for not being stronger on abortion, for diluting their language. And in fact, talking to you right now, I'm thinking of an opinion piece in the New York Times written last January by Cecile Richards, the former president of Planned Parenthood. And in the piece she wrote, "If I have one regret from my time leading Planned Parenthood, it is that we believed that providing vital health care with public opinion on our side would be enough to overcome the political onslaught. I underestimated the callousness of the Republican Party and its willingness to trade off the rights of women for political expediency." Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I think you earlier made a point about the kind of democratic deficit that we see across a lot of the U.S. And I do worry that, you know, weakening of voting rights and access to the ballot, frankly, makes it harder for people to get the kind of policies they want. But it is fundamentally the case that we see public opinion in favor of abortion rights. Where it's polled, people are opposed to abortion bans. And people, when they're sort of you know, given a chance to learn about the issue and to voice their opinion, tend to be pro-choice. One international comparison I'd like to draw to illustrate this point is in Ireland, where back in 2016, 2017, they still had a constitutional abortion ban in Ireland, but what they did was implement something called a citizens' assembly. And that was a kind of a body of voters. They were selected to be representative of the whole population. There were 100 of them. And they met a few weekends in a row and were given presentations about the issue of abortion, Ireland's abortion law, kind of international comparisons. And then they were asked to basically make a recommendation to the Irish legislature. They were asked to say, what do you think should happen? Should we keep our constitutional abortion ban or should we have a referendum to remove it? And, you know, when the results of the Citizens' Assembly in Ireland came in, it was very, very progressive. People, when they learned about the issue, when they were given a chance to consider it, they basically decided, no, we don't want this abortion ban. It doesn't represent our values, and it doesn't represent, you know, the kind of vision we see of a democratic Ireland. So the Citizens' Assembly recommended that it be removed. The legislature decided to hold a referendum. And then in 2018, the general public voted to remove the constitutional abortion ban. So they demonstrated that, you know, that recommendation of the Citizens' Assembly, that was representative of public opinion. Most people, when they learn about this issue and they're given a choice on it, they decide that they want to support abortion rights.
The chapters that you wrote about Ireland and Northern Ireland were very interesting. And it's important to note a few critical events, as you write, most notably a tragic and preventable death, changed the political context of abortion reform in Ireland. After a 2010 European court judgment found that Ireland's abortion ban violated human rights, the government began to explore its options for implementation of this decision. And so before we talk about this tragic death that happened, can you tell us more? What is the background of this 2010 European court judgment that found Ireland's abortion ban violated human rights?
So Ireland had a very sort of complex set of abortion restrictions because they were very unclear. So it had a constitutional ban. But then subsequent court judgments had said, well, abortion is legal if it is needed to preserve life, to, you know, save the life of the pregnant person. But what the European court said is that pathway to obtain a legal abortion is not clear. So it was not clear in Ireland what kind of medical emergencies qualified. How could someone obtain an abortion, even in those very, very narrow circumstances in which it was needed for the preservation of life? So that was that background, that court judgment that basically said, even the abortion restrictions you have are not workable because they're not clear enough for citizens to know when they're entitled to a legal abortion.
You write that coinciding with the European court judgment was the death, the 2012 death of Savita Halappanavar. Halappanavar mm-hmm. died in a Galway hospital after being denied a life-saving abortion. At 17 mm-hmm. weeks of pregnancy, her water broke and she began to miscarry, but did not expel the fetus. Her doctors mm-hmm. refused to intervene because the fetal heart could still be heard. She experienced sepsis and died of a heart attack 7 days after her miscarriage began. Can you talk about how Ireland, the people of Ireland, responded to this horrific tragedy?
Yeah, absolutely. The death of Savita Halappanavar was a seismic event in Ireland, and a lot of activists there have represented it as kind of re-energizing the pro-choice movement there. In Ireland, for a few decades, there had been a kind of understanding and a kind of political stalemate on abortion because politicians basically accepted that although there was a constitutional abortion ban in Ireland, people could just go over to England and get an abortion if they needed it. So there was a little bit of a stalemate and a little bit of a kind of failure of, you know, political elites to take any action on this. And the movement was a little bit in a kind of stagnant moment. What the death of Savita Halappanavar did was galvanize people because it showed them, you know, being able to travel to England is simply not enough. If someone's going to die in an Irish hospital because they're denied an abortion, this is obviously a grave, grave human rights violation and shows us that this constitutional abortion ban is absolutely unworkable. It's endangering everyone's health. So it triggered, you know, street protests, huge activist campaign, pressure groups. And that pressure between 2012 and 2016 built and built and built and finally brought political parties who were keen to avoid the issue, finally brought them to the point where they realized, okay, we have to take action on this. And that's when the Citizens' Assembly that I mentioned previously was put into effect.
It's such a tragic story, and it's shocking that we're dealing with this now here in the United States. As far as I know, we have not had a death. We've had so many journalists on the show who say that they're afraid that this is going to happen in the United States. I mean, I just searched sepsis almost dies, and I got so many articles. The Washington Post just last month, and I just want to find the name. Sepsis nearly killed me. This is what it was like. Pain, fever, an emergency flight to a trauma unit, Jackie Duda. There's so many. We did a show recently about the Texas women who almost died because they could not get abortions. So this is happening right now in this country. What are your thoughts about what might move? I mean, to think that we're looking at Ireland, its population of 5 million people, compared to the United States, which is a massive country and a very different system, although massive majority support for abortion. How do you see, given that you've done research on other countries like Ireland and Northern Ireland, what do you think would be the parallels in terms of what will move here in the U.S.?
It's a good question. And, you know, it's worth saying it's kind of horrifying that we have to think in terms of deaths that could, you know, galvanize public opinion on the issue. No one should have to die so that this issue could be resolved in a democratic way. And, you know, majorities of public support abortion reform in the U.S. In Poland, it's worth drawing a comparison because Poland as well has moved to restrict its abortion law. In 2020, the Polish courts removed a part of the Polish abortion law that had allowed abortion on the grounds of serious fetal anomaly. And since January of 2021, at least six women are known to have died in Poland after doctors refused to terminate their pregnancies, despite complications that pose danger to their lives. So it's worth saying that it's not just a kind of threat in the U.S. There are still people dying all over the world because they're denied legal abortions.
Right. It's such an important point to make. And we hope that does not happen in this country. But as we've seen, so many women, if they're living in states where abortion is illegal, they cannot get the basic care that they desperately need. Today, we're speaking with Sydney Cockin, a senior lecturer in the School of Geography at Queen Mary University of London, co-editor of After Repeal, Rethinking Abortion Politics. Her new book is called Abortion Pills Go Global, Reproductive Freedom Across Borders. Sydney, in the many shows that we've been doing about abortion, so many of the journalists who focus on these issues say the media has utterly failed the media in the United States for not taking all of this seriously. And now we are learning after the fact, after abortion is illegal in 14 states, what the ramifications of that are, where we should have been talking about this for years. And it's very interesting because this issue is not covered so well, a lot of people were thinking, oh, are we going back to the days of the wire hanger? I mean, I heard that a lot after the Roe decision. And people are sort of getting a crash course, I feel, about abortion in this country. And I think a lot of people were surprised to learn that abortion pills are used for more than half of all abortions now in the United States. And because of this very safe procedure, hopefully, we're not going back to the days of the wire hanger because of these pills. Can you talk about how these pills have so drastically transformed the abortion landscape around the world and also here in the U.S.?
Sure. And I think it's a really important point to say that, you know, abortion pills account for or did account for the majority of abortions before the Dobbs decision. It's interesting, you know, scholars who study abortion talk about abortion in terms of something they call a prevalence paradox, which is this idea that abortion is so common, so widely accessed, and yet so shrouded in stigma that people aren't aware of how prevalent it is. I think that this is this kind of helps us understand the question around abortion pills as well. How could it be that they account for half of all abortions, and yet people kind of don't really know what they are or what they do or what their legal status is? My book is about abortion pills, and it's about abortion pills in different contexts all over the world with different kinds of abortion laws. The reason I think abortion pills have been really transformative One of the reasons is that they change the relationship between what is safe and what is legal. So to go back to your point about the sort of coat hanger abortion, I think we're used to thinking about illegal abortion as necessarily being unsafe, right? We're used to thinking about this idea of the quote, you know, back alley abortion, where safe abortion could not be accessed unless it was in a context with permissive abortion laws. Medication abortion pills really mean that that's no longer the case. It's now possible to access a safe abortion with pills, even if somebody lives in a context where the abortion laws are very restrictive and those pills are illegal. And as I show in the book, the way that a lot of people do this is by ordering pills online through feminist activist networks that provide them and ship them around the world, and through online pharmacy vendors that often provide good quality generic medication abortion, again, that they ship around the world.
In your book, you write that abortion language is always politicized, but even among proponents of medication abortion, there's some confusing terminology and blurring of concepts. And for this reason, you cover a few definitions at the outset. Mm-hmm. So can you define medication abortion for us?
Sure. So some people call it medical abortion. I call it medication abortion because I think that that's a little bit clearer. Medication abortion comprises two pills or two sets of pills, mifepristone and misoprostol. Now, mifepristone is in the U.S. known as Mifeprex or RU486. That is the first pill that's taken that basically blocks a hormone that's needed to sustain a pregnancy. And then misoprostol is the second set of pills that are taken 24 to 36 hours later. And they basically induce contractions. And so, you know, the uterus expels the pregnancy. Now, medication abortion is different to what's often known as a surgical or procedural abortion. Medication abortion just means kind of taking this handful of pills. And the other reason I say it kind of blurs some of the concepts we're used to thinking about is because medication abortion is medically indistinguishable from a miscarriage. So, for instance, when people who live in very, very restrictive contexts, when they take abortion pills, if they go to a doctor or a hospital for post-abortion care, the doctor can't tell if they've had a miscarriage or had an abortion.
Right. And that is really important, especially in states where abortion is legal. And in many cases, doctors can face fines or even jail time for helping people who have had a procedure and then might need help after the fact. You write that mifepristone and misoprostol together have been shown to result in an abortion without further medical intervention in 95% of first trimester pregnancies, compared to 87% for misoprostol alone. So these pills at this point have been heavily studied, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, and actually, I'm glad you mentioned that because I should add one final point to my last answer. So I talked about medication abortion as this set of two pills, mifepristone and misoprostol, because when Americans talk about medication abortion, generally we're talking about these two medications together. Misoprostol, which is the second of the two, misoprostol can also be used by itself for abortion. And misoprostol is often easier to get than mifepristone. So in a lot of countries around the world, people would use misoprostol alone to induce abortion, but it's a little bit less effective. So that's why the statistic that you just quoted compares the effectiveness of mifepristone plus misoprostol with the effectiveness of misoprostol alone. But to answer your question, yes, they've been extensively studied. Mifepristone was developed in the 1980s and approved across Europe and parts of Asia thereafter. And misoprostol has been in use for abortion as well since the 1980s. A lot of the this ongoing court case around mifepristone in the U.S., a lot of the sort of debate by various parties in this case relates to the question of whether the pills are safe and whether they've been extensively studied. But it is the case that for decades they've been subjected to, rigorous scientific study. They've undergone clinical trials and they've been used for decades across the world. and have dramatically improved the safety of abortion.
We're going to take a quick break. Sydney Cawkin is senior lecturer in the School of Geography at Queen Mary University of London and author of the new book, Abortion Pills Go Global, Reproductive Freedom Across Borders. She writes that abortion pills have permanently changed the landscape of abortion around the world. Here in the U.S., where abortion is illegal in 14 Republican-controlled states, medication abortion is used for more than half of all abortions. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll discuss Stripped for Parts, American Journalism on the Brink. It's a documentary that tells the story of Alden Global Capital, a hedge fund that is plundering U.S. newspapers. It also focuses on the journalists who are fighting back. What is lost when billionaires who are only concerned with profit take over our news organizations? What can we do about this? We hope you can join us tomorrow. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can email yourcall@kalw.org. And if you'd like to join today's conversation with Sydney Cawkin, author of the new book, Abortion Pills Go Global, Reproductive Freedom Across Borders, we'd love to hear from you. What questions do you have about abortion pills? Other questions for Sydney Cawkin about the work that she did studying Poland, Ireland, Northern Ireland, and the United States. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. I wanted to talk for a few minutes about what is happening with mifepristone in the United States. Last November, anti-abortion doctors filed a lawsuit challenging the FDA's approval of mifepristone back in the year 2000. In early April, Matthew Kaczmarek, a Trump-appointed conservative judge with very deep anti-abortion views, ruled that the FDA improperly approved mifepristone and ordered the medication off the market. And then 5 days later, on emergency appeal, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals issued a preliminary injunction allowing mifepristone to remain on the market, but restricted access while the case was on appeal. And then the DOJ quickly filed an emergency appeal to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court then filed the Fifth Court injunction from taking effect, allowing it to remain on the market until a decision is made. And a couple of days ago, Ms. Magazine reported that a number of stakeholders filed amicus briefs imploring the Supreme Court to preserve abortion pill access. If the justices take up this case, they could hear oral arguments early next year and issue a decision by late June 2024, influencing people's livelihoods are in the hands of really just a few judges. So we don't know what's going to happen with the pill. But as you report in your book, it's really hard to eliminate these pills because they're cheap to obtain, they're easy to move, they're hard to intercept, and they're nearly impossible to detect. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's really important to raise the issue of this ongoing lawsuit around mifepristone because I think it helps us understand the full force of the Dobbs decision, but also maybe a little bit of what was to come after the Dobbs decision. You know, in the Dobbs opinion, the justices wrote that abortion laws would be the preserve of the states and that states could decide what to do with their own abortion laws. But I think that's clearly not the case if now the anti-abortion movement is pushing to ban mifepristone across the entire country. Regardless of the outcome of this case on mifepristone, which, as you say, we're not really sure if the Supreme Court is going to take it up or not. Regardless of the outcome, I think it's important for listeners to know that people use pills to self-manage abortion, and they get those pills from a really wide variety of different sources. Not all of them come through abortion clinics or abortion pill providers that are, you know, licensed by the government. Across the world, people get abortion pills from feminist activist networks and from online pharmacies. And the reason they're able to do this is because although the pills are really hard to obtain, you know, legally through channels in the US, they're quite easy to obtain through pharmaceutical manufacturers from countries like India and China, where the pills are very widely manufactured. And they're not very expensive to buy online. The best available evidence we have that tests these pills shows that the pills that are for sale online and provided through groups like Aid Access are good quality generic medications. It's just that they're not licensed for the American market.
Fascinating. But I just wanted to provide one example. You provide a number of examples in your book. If I go to plancpills.org and say that I live in Texas, where it's illegal, the options I get for pills are online clinics that mail pills about $150 or less. This is with clinician support. This is FDA approved medication. I also get websites that sell pills, $44 and up, with a potential legal risk, generic medications from India. And then if I can't afford this, there are community networks that mail pills. These are free. Again, potential legal risk, generic medications from India. And so if I click on this, see one result, it takes me down to a community network from a Mexican feminist group, Las Libres. Mm-hmm. This is an organization based in Mexico that provides support and access to safe abortion for anyone who requires it. All services are free for those who cannot afford other services. I have to download Proton email, and that's it. So if I were to fill out this information, would I then be able to access these pills?
Yeah, there's a number of different feminist networks around the world that help to provide abortion pills for people that need them. Las Libres is one that operates out of Mexico, but people might also have heard of networks like Women on Web or Women Help Women that also do this. So these kind of services, what they do is they provide a consultation with staff on a help desk. Sometimes there are doctors involved. Sometimes it's just lay activists or kind of, you know, community health workers. They would do a kind of initial assessment with the person. And then if they decide that they're, you know, eligible and their pregnancy is early enough to use medication abortion pills, what they would do is arrange for those to be mailed to the person. That might not be mailed to their home. That might be mailed to a safe place where they can collect the medication. And the medication that they would mail would probably not come directly from the activists themselves. What they do is they usually work with pharmaceutical manufacturers in India who mail the pills from India.
That I found here, if I wanted to go directly through a clinic, maybe mm-hmm. thinking I need this pill now. And it's amazing that these organizations exist, but what if they don't arrive? The other two results where you have to pay out of pocket is Aid Access, $150 or less, 2 to 5 days, and then Cambridge Reproductive Health Consultants, $250 or less, 3 to 5 days. Again, this is saying that I live in Texas, a state that is making it incredibly difficult to access healthcare. I mean, here's a headline from the Telegraph just yesterday. Texas County makes it illegal to transport women across state lines for abortions. Lubbock County joins 6 other jurisdictions banning what anti-choice activists call abortion trafficking.
Yeah, it's deeply troubling. It's also very unclear to me how those laws are enforceable, but I guess that's a separate point. Your point mm-hmm. about the American clinics that will send medication abortion faster is an important one because it raises something new we're seeing in this, which is, you know, as anti-abortion states pass laws that make it harder or near impossible to get an abortion, pro-abortion states in the U.S. are passing shield laws, which shield providers in those states from legal liability, you know, from other states that would try to criminalize them. So some of those providers that you're seeing that say, for instance, they would send pills in Texas, they can do so because they operate out of states where providers have those kind of shield protections in place. And some of the international feminist networks like Women on Web or Aid Access, they work from countries where the abortion providers are legally protected. So that's how they can send pills into countries where it would otherwise be illegal.
Can you talk more about what you learned in India The chapter on India was just absolutely fascinating. I'm wondering if people know that so many abortion pills travel the globe from India. You write extensively about how this originated and then how individuals and activist groups order them online to distribute them.
Yes, and I think this question goes back to something you mentioned earlier when you talked about whether or not media coverage on this area is misleading. Part of what I wanted to get across in the book writing about India is that, you know, there tends to be some kind of fear-mongering in American and European media coverage about Indian pharmaceuticals, right? The idea that they're falsified, fraudulent medications, that they're dangerous somehow. But in fact, my research and the research of others in this area shows the opposite. It shows that the abortion pills manufactured in India that are being distributed by feminist networks are safe, good quality, generic medications. They're very cheap because they've been manufactured in India for many years, and India has an enormous manufacturing sector in generic pharmaceuticals. I think one thing I kind of wanted to communicate with the book is that, you know, there tends to be some kind of fear and anxiety around medications that are bought online, or the idea that, you know, the pharmaceutical vendors of these pills are putting people at risk. But in fact, I think it's countries with anti-abortion laws that are putting people at risk because they're making them turn to the internet, where they have to, you know, navigate different sources of pills, and they have to try to figure out where's a good source for medications. But by and large, what we know about the kind of medication abortion pills that are available online is that they tend to be good quality generic products, and feminist activists who distribute them have long-standing relationships with pharmaceutical distributors who can ensure that the products being received are safe and effective.
The backstory of how India came to make so many abortion pills is also really interesting. You write that bypassing the corporate intellectual property battles ongoing in Europe and the US, pharmaceutical researchers in Asia synthesized their own versions of mifepristone before mifepristone even came to clinical trials in France in 1983. Chinese pharmaceutical companies reverse engineered the drug and began to produce their own version. China licensed its own mifepristone drug in 1988 based on this copy, and something similar happened in India.
Yes. Yeah, so, part of the reason that India has become this sort of global capital for the production of generic pharmaceuticals is because they used to allow companies to patent the process for making a drug, but not the final product. So if a company could kind of reverse engineer its way to it, the same medication, then they could make it. So that allowed the Indian pharmaceutical industry to do this with a number of drugs. But yeah, Indian pharmaceutical manufacturers have been making mifepristone for decades. And because abortion is legal in India, and because their pharmaceutical sector is so, so large, there are many different companies manufacturing mifepristone and misoprostol there. And they form a really, really important source for the kind of cheap, good quality medication abortion that's now used online by people who live in countries with restrictive laws.
You mentioned this earlier, but I think it bears repeating. You write that broadly speaking, there are two pathways for illicit abortion pills to move from Indian producers to consumers abroad. The first pathway is through transnational feminist networks that place individual or bulk orders for their service users. The method is often clandestine but relatively formalized, and the feminist networks inform their clients that they're obtaining safe but illegal medication. The second pathway is online pharmacies, a large and ever-changing group of vendors that sell prescription-only products directly to consumers. It was also very interesting that you tried to talk with people in India about this, pharmaceutical workers, and they didn't want to talk. Have you been able to find just how the overturning of Roe in the United States has affected production of these pills in India?
That's a great question. And actually, the part of the work on India was conducted before the Dobbs decision. So I haven't been able to go back and compare. I mean, I think it's safe to assume that they've seen a big increase in demand based on Aid Access, the feminist activist group that also supplies pills into the US. They reported an enormous uptick in requests for abortion pills after the Dobbs decision. And, they're just one route that people use to obtain pills. So I think it's safe to assume that online vendors have also seen an increase in demand. There were a lot of online vendors I studied who kind of targeted the US as their main market. They saw a huge demand for abortion pills from the US and really kind of catered their service to American clientele. It's true that I was not able to speak with as many of the online pharmacy vendors as I wanted to. I kind of understand. I guess I chalk that up to maybe a natural suspicion of people poking around and asking questions about their business because they work in a bit of a regulatory gray area. And some of the online pharmacies I talk about in the book have been the subject of FDA orders, kind of ordering them to cease providing medication. The FDA doesn't have jurisdiction over these websites based in India, so they can't really shut them down. But nonetheless, they do have law enforcement kind of coming after them and asking them to stop selling pills to American customers. So perhaps it's natural that they were a little bit suspicious when I contacted them about the study.
Sydney Cawkin is the author of the new book, Abortion Pills Go Global, Reproductive Freedom Across Borders. Sydney Cawkin is senior lecturer in the School of Geography at Queen Mary University of London. And if you have any questions or comments about abortion pills, where we are right now, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Let's hear from Jonathan in San Francisco. Hi, Jonathan. Thanks for holding.
Yeah, hi. Thank you. So I have a concern that I recognize that right now there's no way to tell the difference between a medication abortion and a miscarriage. But I would be worried about scientists developing further ways of detecting a medication abortion. Has your guest heard anything about that, or is that a concern for her?
Sydney, your thoughts?
That's a great question. And actually, you're right to be concerned about that. Some listeners might have read a few weeks ago, the New York Times published a report that said scientists in Poland say that they have developed a test that can identify the presence of mifepristone and prove that someone's had a medication abortion. And this report said that scientists in Poland had been already working with law enforcement to use that technology. The sort of stakeholders in this that I've talked to are dubious about, how good the science is there. But I guess that's almost beside the point because, anti-abortion prosecutors and law enforcement who want to criminalize abortion will do so using a variety of means. And one thing I think it's important for us to note when we're thinking about how abortion is criminalized is that sometimes it doesn't even take these kind of sophisticated technologies, like, for instance, a chemical test that could detect mifepristone. The technologies we see that are used to criminalize abortion in the US, for instance, are often much lower tech. That's like social media, like Facebook messages, for instance, emails, for instance. There's a lot of different ways that law enforcement try to prove someone had an abortion rather than a miscarriage. And often that's just by kind of surveilling their digital life rather than using chemical tests that could identify mifepristone.
That is incredible. And thank you for that important question, Jonathan. I'm wondering what your thoughts are about access to these pills, because we know based on study after study, the people who are hurt the most by these bans are poor, people of color, people who just can't make ends meet, people who already have children. And not everyone has access to a computer. Mm-hmm. Some people work three jobs. They're not familiar with these networks. What are your thoughts about access to these pills and the importance of the information getting to the right people? Not just on social media or online. I mean, in many cases, you have to go offline to let people know that this is available.
It's such an important question, and it points to a real difficulty in the advocacy around abortion pills that activists and lawyers who I interviewed for the book spoke about. So it's most safe and effective to use medication abortion pills in the first 12 weeks of pregnancy. After that point, it can be less safe and people can be more likely to be criminalized and detected by law enforcement for doing so. But the difficulty we have is if people don't know about pills, if they are trying to save money to get pills, if they're struggling to get pills, then they might be pushed later and later into pregnancy. That's why in the cases we see in the U.S., the most recent ones where people have been prosecuted and convicted for using abortion pills, it's people who use them in the second trimester. So it's a really, really important point that what we need to see is pathways to get information to people about medication abortion, safe pathways to access it, and information about how to afford medication abortion. You know, a €90 donation or a $110 donation is simply too much for many people. So it would also, expand access if we were to raise awareness about abortion funds that can provide for subsidized pills or donated pills to people who need them.
What are your thoughts about where restrictions on pills might go here in the U.S.? I mean, we're waiting to see if the Supreme Court is going to take that case. You write that restrictions on medication abortion at the state level generally fall into three categories: mifepristone protocols that regulate dosage and clinic visits, physical proximity requirements that regulate the physician-patient interaction, and telemedicine bans that prohibit medication abortion from being prescribed by phone, video, or online consultation. I mean, even though, as you say, these pills are small, they're hard to detect, they're easy to transport, we know that hardline Republican anti-choice politicians and activists really want to ban abortion pills in this country. I mean, they're going after birth control.
Yeah, and you know, those categories that you mentioned for mifepristone restrictions, those are the ways that mifepristone was restricted before the Dobbs decision. After Dobbs, we've seen outright abortion bans in a variety of states. And, you know, where a state bans abortion, they're ban abortion by any method. So that's surgical and medication abortion. To your question about how anti-abortion, movement or legislators are coming for medication abortion, it seems to be a variety of different ways. I mean, one is to bring this court case that would revoke the approval of mifepristone altogether. So that would be to say, even in places in the country where abortion is legal, medication abortion cannot be prescribed. That's one way that they're doing it. They're also proposing statutes that would criminalize prescribing medication abortion from a state where it's legal if those pills are used in a state where it's illegal. They're trying to criminalize the provision of abortion information, trying to ramp up criminalization of abortion pill users. We've seen moves in some places to almost tie the hands of prosecutors to make it so that they have to pursue charges against people for illegal abortion. And, you know, another move that we're seeing to criminalize abortion and to enforce that criminalization across the board, but which implicates medication abortion, are the kind of bounty hunter laws like SB 8 that we saw in Texas, which kind of delegates enforcement of the law to civilians, not to law enforcement. So basically tries to incentivize people to bring suit against anyone they think has helped, quote, aid and abet an abortion.
A new study just came out yesterday. It got a lot of coverage in the media about how abortions are actually not going down post-Dobbs.
Yeah.
Which is not surprising because so many people say if someone does not want be pregnant, they will do whatever they can to ensure that they are able to terminate a pregnancy. And so I just wonder what your thoughts are on that. Because a number of people are saying, well, what's happening is that this issue is just getting obviously more attention than ever. And then in the states where it is legal, they're opening new clinics. They are doing more to raise money to ensure that people can travel. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, you're right. I saw that come out yesterday and it was really interesting. I mean, it definitely showed us the way that the geography of abortion in the US is changing. You know, the states where abortion bans have been passed, maybe unsurprisingly, a lot of that demand has been displaced to other states. And so, you know, we've seen huge increases in states where abortion is legal because people are traveling to those states. As you say, some of them are building new clinics as well to cope with the level of demand. I think it's really important to say that distance is a huge barrier for some people to access abortion. The mere fact that abortion is legal in the state next to you doesn't mean that you have the financial means or the social support or the time off work to access it. So distance raises the costs, distance delays people, distance is still an enormous obstacle to abortion. Even as we see, you know, numbers rise and sort of new clinics open in certain states across the country.
Right. And I should say that that study was from #WeCount, a research project led by the Society of Family Planning. And I'm glad you said that, Sydney, because Robin Marty with the West Alabama Women's Center comes on our show all the time and says, I am dealing with so many people who do not have the ability to travel. And we are just really letting them down on so many levels because they're not getting the care that they need and they cannot just up and travel to the next state. She said so many people cannot do that and we have to remember them. So thank you for bringing that up. Sydney Calkin is the author of Abortion Pills Go Global, Reproductive Freedom Across Borders. Sydney Calkin is senior lecturer in the School of Geography at Queen Mary University, London. And you can find out more about her work at yourcallradio.org. Sydney, thanks so much for your work and thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org and also check out all of our past shows. Thanks to Sarah Lee Sterland for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering our show. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.